Hello and welcome to today's episode of Ask Alan. And of course, this week we're joined by our SMSF coach, Olivia Long from Prime Financial Group. G'day, Olivia. Great to talk to you. And sorry about you lost your voice last week. So I think there's quite a few questions for you to answer this week.
That's great. It's good to have you back.
Yes, well, it's good to be back. And remember, everyone, the answers are general advice, not personal advice, may not be appropriate for you. So please bear that in mind. If you've got any questions, put them on the Ask Alan section of the Eureka Report website, and we'll get to them next week. And if you've got any questions for Olivia, she joins us every month. So please put the questions for her in the same place, and she'll get to them when she next joins us, which will be in a month's time. So let's get going. The first one's for you, Olivia. Off you go.
Great. Now, this question's a long one, but it's a good one, so bear with me. Brian says, Alan, good to see you back and needing questions. Very good, Brian. The different types of offerings for someone wanting to set up an SMSF can be confusing and time-consuming. Good help is not always available. The do-it-all-yourself option still needs annual accounts, and to be audited and not complying with the rules is a danger. There are a few APRA SMSF-style funds that do the record-keeping, prepare accounts and tax, but their fees, ironically, are based on the value of the fund. If you perform well, you pay them more fees, it seems. I suppose you both have SMSFs. Can Olivia give a brief description of the facility Prime offers and the reports produced? Is there access to online brokerage? If needed, is there investment advice? Even though cash rates are low, there seems to be a potential bonanza of dividends coming the way of SMSFs in pension mode. So what's the general timing for lodging tax returns so the cash can be reinvested? Very good questions, Brian. So firstly, I've had an SMSF for over 15 years now. What about you, Alan?
20 probably.
Yep. Good. So we're both definitely SMSFs. And look, running an SMSF can be onerous for some. The admin burden can be time-consuming, and as a trustee, you literally need to do everything yourself in relation to any investment administration, such as direct shares, and bundle all of the information up and take it to your accountant after the end of the financial year. So for that reason, historically, many advisors actually preferred what's called a small APRA fund, or what's known as a SAF, instead of an SMSF. Now, SAFs generally provide a service where you or your advisor can decide where to invest, and they'll handle the execution of the trading, the investment admin, and the year-end financial and tax reporting. But the only problem with this is as your fund balance increases, so do your fees, as you've kindly pointed out, Brian. And personally, I strongly oppose percentage-based fees. So look, at Prime, we do provide an SMSF specialist service. Now, the industry has evolved and we've seen quite a number of firms growing in this space over the past 10 to 15 years that do offer a far better solution than what a traditional accountant does, and usually for a much better price, which is surprising. But look, by leveraging technology, we do provide a full administration service that includes the accounting, tax and compliance and audit for around $2,500. Now, the average SMSF fee reported by the ATO, just by the way, is $3,750. So the benefit of a service like us or an SMSF specialist is that they will provide the service for a flat fee. So it's not linked to the balance of the fund. As you know, you can have up to six members in the fund, which also doesn't impact the fees. But as your fund's balance increases by performance and contributions over time, the fixed fee as a percentage of your fund reduces. And look, Brian says, isn't this similar to InvestSmart's fixed fee product, Alan? Is that the case?
Slight differences, but yeah. I mean, the InvestSmart product is the fee is capped.
Yep, I gotcha.
So it's 0.55 up to $80,000 or so dollars, and then it stays at $451 a year after that, no matter how much money you put in.
Got it. Okay. So, look, in my opinion, these days time is money. Why people still deal with old school accounting methods with their SMSF is honestly beyond me, because who has the time or desire to do more paperwork? Definitely not me. So we're seeing increasing numbers of people that converting their SAF into an SMSF, and we're seeing lots of people see significant reductions in their running costs, which is great because many people aren't even aware that they can do that. The next question is for me from Gail. It says, good morning, Alan. What do you think about the government's proposal for a retirement income covenant? And in particular, why should SMSF trustees be exempt, bearing in mind Mike Callaghan's calculation that by 2060, a third of the money paid out of the superannuation system will be by way of inheritance rather than retirement income? So, Gail, look, great question. For those that haven't heard, draft legislation was recently released which created a legal duty for prudentially regulated super trustees, so that's APRA funds, to devise, implement and regularly review a retirement income strategy for its members. So it's proposed to be in place from the 1st of July next year and will apply to all super funds other than SMSFs. So this is an interesting one because there's evidence to support the fact that there's a growing body of retirees dying with most of their wealth intact. And I suppose the government want the message they're trying to send is spend, if you've got it, spend it. So my thoughts are it's a good thing that SMSFs are exempt at this stage because the requirements of trustees is already quite onerous. But look, while they're exempt from the actual legislation and being forced to do it, it doesn't mean they're exempt from the spirit of what the government is are trying to achieve, which is, you know, now more than ever with what's happened, you know, in our economy in the past 2 years. If you've got the money, spend it and enjoy it. So hopefully SMSF trustees will do that and across the board will have the desire, we'll see the desired impact at some point. So what are your thoughts on this one, Alan?
I think I'm in full agreement with you.
You can't take it with you.
No, that's right. No, absolutely. Part of the problem with inheritance these days is, I'm not sure this is germane to the question, but yeah. Everyone's living so much longer. The children now are much older.
Yes.
And approaching retirement by the time you die.
Yes.
So inheritance becomes less useful. For the kids. And so, my plan is to give them as much as I can while I'm alive.
Yeah. Do you know what I'd personally like to see? I'd like to see more people doing that so that their children and their families can actually afford to spend more time not only with their parents and their loved ones but with their children. You know, we're all on this. Everyone's so busy these days working and killing themselves trying to, you know, have two parents working and doing what you can just to sort of get by, just make life a little bit easier on your family at the point when they need it, which is, you know, when they're raising kids and they're paying school fees, in my opinion.
Yeah, so I haven't retired yet, but when I do, I'm going to make sure I've got enough to last Deb and I until, you know, through our retirement, but anything left over, we're going to give to the kids.
Yeah, good one. Okay, next question's for you.
Next one's from me. Margaret says, hi, Alan. My question is regards super. I have a small super balance, $100,000. I can't give personal advice, but anyway, we'll press on. And 15 to 20 years to retirement. I've recently taken steps to make it work better for me, starting voluntary contributions and moving to a consistently performing fund. To begin with, I've chosen a low fee, 0.6% index option investment option with good returns, 9.67%. It's been suggested I change my investment option to a high growth fund with higher returns and a higher fee, 1.1%. What do you suggest I consider prioritise when deciding on the investment type that's right for me at this stage and balance of my super, lower fees or slightly higher growth? Well, obviously it's all about the after fee growth that you achieve. The one thing you can say for sure is that you know what the fees are, but you don't know what the returns are going to be. You can tell what the returns have been in the past, and these super funds always tell you that the past performance is no guide to the future performance, which is true. Look at those numbers you gave, and again, just bearing in mind this is totally general advice. I don't know your circumstances, so can't advise you particularly, but the difference between 9.67 and 10.93 is not much, and in fact it's about the same as the fee. So that's not enough of a difference to increase your fees by almost double, I would suggest. You'd want more than that. But on the other hand, in general, 15 to 20 years to go is a fair while. You can afford to go to high growth options, but just watch the fees. You don't need to pay more than 1% for a super fund fee. high growth. There are plenty of super funds that are offering high growth options at much less than that, probably 0.6, I don't know for sure, but look around. You'll find that, for example, the best performing fund in the past 12 months was UniSuper. I'd have a look on their website, check out their high growth option, see what their fee is, and at least you know with them, for example, that they've done well in the past and there's a fair chance they'll do well in the future because they seem to know what they're doing. But that's about all I can tell you. Do you have a comment on that, Olivia?
Yeah, no, look, I agree absolutely. And you can actually Google the best performing super funds and drill down and get all of that information online. So the more educated people are and the more research they do, the better off they're going to be.
Yep. Okay, your turn.
Great. Next question from Mark is, could Olivia step through the impact on the tax-free percentage of an SMSF pension that after a few years of earnings and drawdowns then receives a non-concessional contribution within the appropriate limits, of course? Okay, so when a pension commences, the taxable and the tax-free components are crystallised so that any amounts then received or paid from a member's balance will be done based on those proportions. Now, for those that don't know, the tax-free component mainly consists of non-concessional contributions or after-tax contributions, as many call them. It can also include spouse contributions, child contributions, government co-contributions, and payments made under the low-income super tax offset. So all other amounts made to the fund, so such as concessional contributions and income from the fund's investments, then form part of the taxable component. So you have a percentage of tax-free and taxable. So this becomes important when a person dies because any death benefits paid to adult children or an estate actually pay tax on the taxable component, while the tax-free component doesn't pay tax. So back to your original question here, Mark. When a non-concessional contribution is received by a fund, a second pension can commence to once again crystallise that tax-free component. But it is possible to do a stop and restart of the first pension and combine them into one. But if there's a significant difference in the tax components between the original pension and the new amount to move into pension mode, it can be better from an estate planning viewpoint to keep the two separate. So this is an area where, you know, seeking the advice from a financial advisor would be beneficial. So the next question from Sandeep is for me. It says a question relating to SMSFs in pension and accumulation mode simultaneously. We will be converting our SMSF to pension mode and continue to have a small account accumulation mode component this financial year. Our accountants have indicated that we need to do quarterly reporting of the accounts, whereas I'm not sure whether this is just for their convenience or a requirement. I'd like your opinion on this. Okay, so Sandeep, honestly, in my personal opinion, any SMSFs paying a pension should be processed at a very minimum of quarterly for a number of reasons, but the primary reason is because of transfer balance account reporting requirements of the ATO. So if your pension is valued at more than $1 million, then your accountant is asking because the ATO needs them to report any activity each quarter. And they won't be able to report on it if they're not at processing and looking at what you're doing in the fund. So a transfer balance account report to the ATO, by the way, enables the ATO to record and track an individual's balance for both their transfer balance cap and their total super balance.
David says, hi, Alan, what are your thoughts on borrowing to invest in shares? I'm thinking more NAB Equity Builder, InvestSmart Fund Later or similar, non-margin lending versus property. What does one need to consider in making that decision? Well, the main thing you need to consider is that shares are more volatile in general than property, obviously, and so therefore how that affects you. In the long-term, shares tend to do better or roughly the same as property over the long term. So long term, it's fine and no difference. You can borrow more for property than you can for shares. Typically, you can only borrow about 50% for shares, whereas you can borrow 80% for property. The other thing to consider, also the fact that it's more volatile means that if you need the money in the short term, it means that the moves of the share market are exaggerated by borrowing means that if you need the money in a hurry, you're in trouble if the market's down. So you just need to bear that in mind. The other thing to bear in mind is margin lending, which you don't seem to be considering. But with a margin loan, if the share market falls, you could be asked to top up, that is to say, maintain the margin at whatever it is, 50%, so that you have to cough up some cash. Now, if you stick with non-margin lending, you're fine. You don't need to worry about that. Have I forgotten anything, Olivia?
No, I think that was a very succinct answer there.
Good.
Right. So Peter says, what is the SMSF process when I or my wife die? Is there scope to add children into the SMSF so it becomes a de facto family trust? So, hi, Peter. As you probably know, SMSFs can have up to 6 members in a fund. When either you or your wife die, basically at that point you can decide to get one of your children to step in as a trustee at that point or establish a corporate trustee. So you've got two choices there. But look, even if you add your children to your SMSF at that point, unless they're considered dependents, any death benefits that pass to them will need to be paid out of the fund to them regardless. So that the only real benefit in adding them to your fund is that they'll be able to utilise any carried forward tax losses held by the fund against any future capital gains that they may have. So that's really the main benefit I can think of. Next question is from Ted. He says, hi, Olivia. If my SMSF is in retirement phase and I sell an ETF with a large capital gain over many years to fund my pension, does the SMSF pay capital gains tax or is it exempt from tax? I'm contemplating selling now while I'm in accumulation phase to buy something else, but if I can wait 3 to 4 years and receive the gain tax-free, then that makes much more sense. So, Ted, you're spot on. If you hold off 3 to 4 years, then the gain is entirely tax-free. So it's a good idea to factor that into your decision making. But remember, the maximum tax paid when you're in accumulation mode is 15%, which is then reduced by a further third if you've held the ETF for more than 12 months. So I suppose do your make a decision between what you're contemplating buying and that tax fee and go from there.
Next one's from me, from Rufus. Hi, Alan, avid follower of ER, et cetera. I'm interested to know if you found any interesting research into Fortescue's clean steel hydrogen technology you referred to recently. Are they making meaningful progress to a game-changing innovation? Well, it's early days, Rufus. They have said, as recently as yesterday, I think they're going for net zero emissions by 2040, and they're looking for technology to replace, to make steel with hydrogen. And they've said they're going to invest billions of dollars in this. So, look, I haven't really got anything to tell you about whether it's going to work or not. I think everyone thinks it will, but it's a fair way to go. And, you know, I think it's a bit early to say whether they're making meaningful progress, but they're putting meaningful money into it anyway, Rufus, so maybe it'll work. Hopefully it will, because steel making is one of the highest emitting manufacturing processes around. So, you know, they need to do something about that. Your turn.
Great. Nicola says, please forgive me if this has been asked and answered, but I'm new to this. You're forgiven, Nicola. In my SMSF, which is in pension and accumulation mode, I have a number of shares that have capital gain and a number that have a capital loss. I know that the gain can be offset against the loss when it's sold, but is it advisable to do it as a matter of course? I suppose what I'm asking is it advisable to sell the shares that cancel the gain with the loss and then buy them back the next day in order to limit the gains that might come into effect if I accidentally shuffled off? Great question, Nicola. You can choose to sell the shares, which are recording a loss for that reason, but if you buy the shares back again the next day, especially if it's the same amount, it could be frowned upon by the ATO as tax evasion. Now, tax evasion is defined as the illegal abuse of the taxation system for financial benefit. So in Australia, tax evasion or tax fraud is criminalised by both the federal government and state governments and carries a maximum penalty of up to 10 years imprisonment. So personally, I'd avoid doing something quite so transparent. If anything, you could say, as an example, sell one bank share and then buy back a different bank, which then still maintains your exposure to that sector without making it obvious that you're doing what's known in the industry as a wash trade.
The old wash trade, you've got to watch that. They'll be absolutely onto you.
Absolutely. Next question from David is, last financial year, I was fortunate to be able to add $300,000 as a non-concessional contribution to my super using the three-year bring forward rule. This means I could normally not add any more for the next two financial years, but now that the feds have increased the non-concessional cap to 110k from the 1st of July, can I now add an extra 30k as an extra non-concessional contribution for financial years 21 and 22? So the short answer to this, David, is no. Once you trigger the bring forward rule, you can't then make any further contributions, non-concessional contributions, until that time has lapsed. So irrespective of the amount going up. So in future, I'd say if you know that the government are due to increase that amount, maybe just plan your contribution so that you trigger that bring forward rule in the year where it actually goes up.
Martin says, hi, Alan, welcome back. A few years ago, I purchased two shares listed on the London Stock Exchange, and I did this through CompSec on the phone. I later discovered that CompSec had purchased the shares on an OTC market over the counter. I questioned them about this, but they assured me that it wouldn't make any difference. This week, I received an email from CompSec saying they were terminating the ability to trade on the US OTC pink markets. The email goes on to say that I don't need to sell my holdings. They will continue to support selling only. I don't fully understand the implications of this. Should I sell my shares? Look, I don't have any direct experience of this, but if CompSec says you don't need to sell your holdings, that they'll continue to support selling, I would take them at their word and don't sell unless you want to get rid of those shares. I'd make the decision purely on the basis of an investment view of the shares themselves rather than some technical thing about CompSec. Unless you don't trust them, I mean, they're a pretty big outfit. They're probably trustworthy, but you know, these things change. Who knows? I mean, but look, as I say, I don't have any direct experience of this. Whether they'll chop off your ability to sell at some point, I mean, it's hard to believe, really.
That's quite unlikely.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah,
yours.
Okay, next question from Suze. Hi, Alan and Olivia. Thanks muchly for your most informative casual session. Thoroughly enjoy it. Olivia, if I transfer $1.4 million from accumulation to pension mode, then a few months later do a commutation of $400K, what happens to my transfer balance cap? Can I later move $700K from my accumulation to pension to maximise the $1.7 million? Or do I make any sense? Yes, Suze, you make perfect sense. Yes, if you do a commutation, then this will create room in your personal transfer balance cap. But you need to make sure that your accountant records it as a commutation and not a pension payment, and that they lodge the transfer balance report to the ATO within 28 days of the end of the quarter, as you'll have more than $1 million in super. Next question from Peter. Says, my question is for Olivia and relates to the taxation of dividends from overseas companies within an SMSF. Our SMSF holds mainly US stocks through the CompSec international platform. In a recent example, we received a dividend from Apple into our international cash account, followed by an immediate deduction of a non-resident alien tax of 15% of the dividend. I've heard that this tax is recoverable when the SMSF tax return is submitted, but I may have misunderstood. Can you please clarify? So, Peter, the use of foreign tax credits is quite complicated to explain, but because unlike franking credits, which are fully refundable, you can only use a foreign tax credit to offset any foreign income up to a certain threshold. So I would suggest Google W-8BEN, and that will help explain it to you, but definitely a complex area. Over to you, Alan.
Margaret says, hi, Alan. I've got an 11-year-old daughter for whom I would like to set up an investment fund. Obviously, time is on her side, minimum 10 years, and I'm starting very modestly, $10,000, with a plan for ongoing contributions. What are my options to minimise tax impact for me and for her future and maximise returns? If there are any resources, can you point for my education? You probably need to get some advice on this because I had a look into this a bit myself and found that it was a bit of a tax bloody nightmare. And the problem is if you set up trusts, with you as the trustee, the tax is yours. You got to pay the tax. So if there's capital gains tax, it goes to you. And so you just got to watch that. I'd get some advice. What do you think, Olivia?
I agree, but I think you could do what a lot of my clients are doing and buy precious metals and bury it in the backyard.
Really?
Yeah, that seems to be a popular strategy at present. Don't ask me why.
What, for kids? For their kids?
For them and for the future.
Right.
Precious metals.
Precious metals. Bury in the backyard. Goodness me.
I know.
Oh, well.
Moving on. Chris says, hi, Alan, and perhaps Olivia. We're in the process of setting up an SMSF. There's a great deal of information available online, but I cannot seem to find articles on how many stocks to hold in a fund. Many provide percentages of funds to allocate according to various risk profiles, but we're trying to decide on what to actually buy as investments. Just how many different stocks is too many? We are still working, but we will be setting up pensions in the fund. Look forward to your input. So, Alan, I'm not sure on this one. Do you have a magic number, in your opinion?
I don't have a magic number, but my view is it has to do with how much time you're going to devote to it. I mean, if you're doing it part-time, then I would keep it at less than 10 stocks because you've really got to keep an eye on these things. You can't just let it go. If you're going full-time, if you're retired and or you've got more time on your hands, maybe 20. You don't need to go much, in my view, you don't need to go much above 20 to get proper diversification, possibly 30, but certainly not 50, particularly if you're running it yourself. I mean, if you've got a team of people, you're running an investment fund and you've got a team of people and all that stuff, you could probably invest in 50 stocks or even 100 stocks, as many of them do. But if you're on your own, really you're talking 10 to 20 max, in my view. And the difference between the two depends on how much time you're going to devote to it. Oh, the next one's me as well. Hi, Alan. I'm a relatively new investor and I'm wary of a correction that I think is likely to occur due to a number of global conditions, stimulus ending, money printing, chance of permanent inflation, Evergrande, US debt repayment ceilings, etc. What do you think are the top three factors that could trigger the stock market to crash significantly? And how long do you think it would take to recover to close to current levels post-crash? Okay, well, the number one thing, the first thing I should say is that if you're an investor in the stock market, the one thing you can be sure of is you're going to get whacked with a correction at some point. You should be able to get away with a crash. I mean, I'd count the difference between a correction and a crash is like 10% versus 30 to 50%. The crash was in October 87. The crash was in March last year. As a result of the pandemic. But corrections happen all the time. So, look, yes, you're going to get a correction at some point. The main reason the correction happens is because stocks go high. They go up and arguably go up a bit too much, and then they correct to a more reasonable price. So that's the number one reason for corrections. As for external, what you might call exogenous reasons for corrections at the moment, the key reason is inflation and that leading to increases in interest rates, both on the market, long-term interest rates, bond rates, and also central bank short-term interest rates. So central banks, or the Australian Reserve Bank, is saying interest rates won't go up for 2020 till 2024. The market thinks interest rates are going to go up next year. So there's a big difference between what the market is saying about interest rates and what the Reserve Bank is saying. And the Reserve Bank is also a bit out of step with other central banks around the world. So, for example, the Norwegian Central Bank has just put up interest rates. The New Zealand Central Bank is expected to put interest rates up today, might have done so already. I haven't looked. And there are expectations that central banks generally everywhere are going to start putting up interest rates next year as a result of inflation. So that is one cause that could cause a correction. I don't think Evergrande will, because it's going to be rescued by the Chinese government. It's already being rescued. That's about it, I guess. I mean, inflation's it, really. And the markets are on edge about inflation. And you saw September a correction of 5% from the peak on August the 13th until basically the 1st of October, the market fell 5% here. So that's not quite a correction, but it was a bit of a fall and it was caused by fear of inflation. So it's all about your own views, Tom, as to what you're comfortable with. If you are convinced that there's going to be a correction, then I'd be very careful. Not everyone is convinced, however. So you just need to make up your own mind and stuff like that. Over to you.
Okay, Sue says, hello, Alan and Olivia. Can I still make a concessional contribution into an accumulation super account, even though I've fully met my transfer balance cap already in pension mode in my SMSF? So the answer is yes, assuming you meet all the other requirements applicable to you, such as the work test. Maximising the total super balance cap only stops you from making non-concessional contributions. So you've still got the ability to make concessional contributions and the downsize of contributions, as these aren't actually impacted by the cap. The next question is a good one from Terence. He says, Alan, I'm interested in the reactions of professionals to the announcement from APRA assessing the recent performance of super funds. My thoughts are in brief. Have they dug deep into the underlying investments behind every fund? For example, the balanced option in probably every fund will differ from every other fund, so is a comparison valid? Have they or will they assess the returns of SMSFs? Have they considered that many investors choose their own spread within a managed fund? If not, is their proclamation valid? If they expect every fund to perform to their retrospective ideal, there is little point in having a large range of funds. So one fund with the one investment spread approved by APRA should do the trick. So my unprofessional view of this offering from APRA is that it's half-baked and cherry-picked and a misleading mischief. So look, for those of you that don't know, the September quarter, for the first time, we saw the super funds that were deemed to be underperforming by APRA named and shamed, and there were some large institutions on that list that would have surprised quite a few people. I'd say that most of us, to be honest, would like to see greater insight into how they actually assess the super fund's performance, because SMSF's fund performance is closely scrutinised by trustees or their advisors, and that happens on a regular basis. But I think that the level of scrutinisation that APRA has over the rest of the funds is a good thing, because I can tell you the majority of people I speak to almost on a daily basis, when I ask them about their existing super, cannot tell me how their fund's performing or what they're even paying for their existing super. So I think it's a good thing conceptually that the government are trying to protect these people by scrutinising fund performance for them, but are they doing it properly, I think, would be the better question, as you've asked. So over to you, Alan.
Carlos says, hi, Alan, love your podcast and always listen. I hope you're feeling better from your knee troubles. Thank you, I am. Can you tell us a bit more about IGO Limited, or perhaps invite their CEO for an interview? You've gone on to talk about a bit about IGO, and I have to tell you, I know nothing about this company, so I'm going to have to say yes, we'll put them on their list for an interview as soon as possible. Sounds interesting. They've got lithium and stuff, so they're on the list, but I have absolutely no idea about them. Next.
Okie doke. Katrina says, I have $1.3 million in an accumulation account and I'm not sure how to invest it now I'm retiring. I've been to see two financial advisors who are proposing wrap accounts. They say will deliver around 8% over the long term, but the fees look high and constant buying and selling makes me a bit anxious. My instinct is to go with an industry fund, but I'm not sure if it's worth moving all my money to another fund on the basis of their performance with retirement accounts, because I can't seem to find good information on the comparative returns for balanced ethical retirement investment accounts. The available info seems to relate to accumulation accounts. My account is currently with Aware, which seems to have a variable ranking depending on what you read. I probably can't comment here too much. Do you have a recommendation there, Alan?
I'd be very careful of financial advisors and wrap accounts. Their fees are high, and they'll just bleed you in sometimes. I mean, not always, but 8% can easily be provided by a super fund, industry super fund, easily, I mean, and more with a lower fee. I mean, my view, my advice perhaps would be for Katrina to start with Aware, which is where she is already, and see what they're like. And if they're no good, okay, look elsewhere. But surely Aware has, I don't know if this for sure, but you would think Aware has a retirement product for you that means you don't have to leave them in order to retire. I think one of the problems with superannuation in this country is these super funds regard themselves as savings vehicle rather than retirement vehicles, and they market themselves with their savings returns, and then everyone retires and they just hand over the money, and send them off to a financial advisor. I mean, I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
These super funds should market themselves as retirement companies. And what they do and what their job is to look after you in retirement, in my view. So anyway, that's just a bugbear of mine. Min says, hi, Alan. I'm about to refinance my home loan. AMP rate looks very good compared to the major four banks. Do you or your expert team feel safe to go with AMP given their financial problems? What would be the pros and cons between choosing the major four versus AMP? Would AMP go belly up in the next 2 years, and how would that affect the home loans? Well, you're okay if you've got the, if you've got their money rather than the other way around, that you've given them your money. But if you've got their money, it doesn't matter if they go broke, because all that'll happen is that your loan will get sold to someone else by the liquidator. I'm not saying they will go belly up, but if they do, you'll be fine. I'm not in a position to comment about AMP's quality as a lender and what its rates are. I don't even know what their rates are, but, you know, if you're borrowing off them, you don't need to worry about them going broke. And that's it.
That is it.
Thanks, everyone, for your excellent questions, particularly for Olivia, who has provided even better answers, as usual.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, Olivia, and it's great to be with you again on this. I look forward to our next outing.
Absolutely.
Have a great week and month.
I will. And we'll see you next month.
See you later. Thanks, everyone. And I'll see you, everybody, next week.